You are listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast, focusing on the changing nature of retirement today and the non-financial aspects of a successful retirement transition. Join host Joe Casey and learn from leading experts in the field and the stories of people who created interesting second acts as they share practical ideas and tips to create your own. Check out our website at retirementwisdom.com, where you can download our newsletter and other resources to learn more about how coaching can help you. The best way to support this podcast is to head over to Apple Podcasts and post a rating and a comment. It's easy and it's free. Join our conversations and get wiser about your retirement.
Welcome to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Casey. If you're listening to this podcast, you and I have something important in common. We're getting older. Question is, how can you age successfully? We're fortunate enough today to have an opportunity to talk to the person who wrote the book on it. Our guest today is Dan Levitin. He's the author of Successful Aging. A neuroscientist explores the power and potential of our lives. Dan Levitin, PhD, is a neuroscientist, cognitive psychologist, and best-selling author. He is founding dean of arts and humanities at the Minerva Schools at KGI in San Francisco, and professor emeritus of psychology and neuroscience at McGill University. He's the author of This Is Your Brain on Music, The World in Six Songs, The Organized Mind, and A Field Guide to Lies. He divides his time between California and Montreal. Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, what led you to write Successful Aging?
Well, I realized that as my parents rounded 80, that neuroscience had learned a whole lot about the aging process and at every stage of life, in fact, and that there were things we knew about how to better prepare for becoming old and things that we can do once we are older. And I wanted to give my parents a book that explained all this new neuroscience, and I couldn't find one. So as with all my other books, I ended up writing the book I wanted to read.
And how do you define successful aging?
To me, successful aging is at any life stage. I mean, we start aging as soon as we're born, hopefully. I mean, the alternative is we die. So, or, you know, even in a coma, we're aging. So to me, successful aging is that in any part of your life, you're able to enjoy the things you enjoy doing. You're able to do things that are meaningful to you. And just because you're 50 or 70 or 90, that doesn't mean those things have to stop.
And what are some of the misconceptions or even myths about aging that you see out there?
Well, there's two big ones. One is a societal narrative that aging is associated with a time of decline, and that's not true. In every decade, we gain some abilities and we lose others. There's no 30-year-old who has, well, few 30-year-olds who have the childlike flexibility of a 5-year-old or the ability to repair a broken bone as easily. And there are few 80-year-olds who are as quick at retrieving words or ideas as a 25-year-old, you know, when you count for similarities in education and IQ and things like that. So each stage of life, each decade is associated with some growth and with some loss of certain things. And so the misconception is that after a certain age, we just decline, and that's just not true. It is true that with every decade after 40, we slow down. That's why I mentioned the slowing down. But we gain in other ways. We're better at pattern matching. We're better at solving problems. And we become more, most of us, more likely to experience empathy for others and gratitude. A second big misconception is the one of failing memory. It's not necessarily a case that memory goes when you reach an older age. It's just that it's played up in the media. It's a thing that we see depicted in movies and TV shows. But in fact, Alzheimer's is relatively rare, thankfully. That's one of the leading sources of memory loss. And it may take us longer to remember things when we're older, but that doesn't mean our memories aren't working. That's just the general slowing down.
And how do our brains change as we age?
Well, we could talk about this for an hour. There's an explosion of neuronal growth in the first few years of life as our brains wire themselves up to the world that they experience around them. But we continue growing new neurons and we continue growing new neural pathways until the day we die. You can learn things at any age, and every time you learn something, that's a whole bunch of thousands of new neural pathways being formed. Our brains shrink a bit as we get older, which means that getting hit in the head can cause more damage because there's less of a buffer between the brain and the skull. And as we age, some systems in the brain become less efficient, particularly neurochemical systems that govern sleep and wakefulness and mood.
What are older brains better at than younger brains?
Well, I guess two things I already mentioned, better at problem solving / pattern matching and better at experience empathy for others. But it's worth unpacking that idea of pattern matching. Your brain is a giant pattern detector. As a kid, you might have seen animals inside clouds in the sky, or you might have stared at an acoustic ceiling in your classroom with a bunch of holes in it and seen patterns dance around. Or maybe that's just me. But the brain's function is to extract patterns. And the more things you've experienced, the more able you are to see patterns in things. And there's no substitute for it. There's no shortcut other than living life and having a lot of different experiences. And as a rule, people who are 60 or 80 have had more experiences than people who were 10 or 20.
So what are your thoughts on wisdom and how it's acquired and its relevance, if anything, to age?
I think that wisdom is the ability to see patterns that other people don't see and to use that understanding to solve problems that might elude others. We, you know, in Western culture, Solomon was the great paradigm of somebody who was wise. The thing to keep in mind about the Solomon story and the two mothers who both claimed that a baby was theirs, this was not a primitive society, Solomon's kingdom. There were systems of courts and magistrates, and these two women would have worked their way up through the chain, and nobody had solved the problem. By the time it comes to the king, this is a problem that some very smart and capable people weren't able to solve. And he figured it out. So that's wisdom. And we get better at it the more experiences we've had. Some of us are wise younger, but we continue to gain it through experience and insight and a bit of analysis.
One of the things that struck me in reading your book is the roles that personality and mindset play in successful aging. I'd love to hear you share more about that.
Well, so it turns out that in the science of individual differences, we talk about the thousands of ways that we humans differ from one another. And one of the big ones is conscientiousness. It's the biggest single predictor, much more so than socioeconomic status, of how your life is going to turn out at any age. Conscientiousness is a cluster of different things having to do with reliability, dependability, exercising due caution, rule following, and to some degree. A kid who's conscientious isn't going to cross against the light and so is less likely to get hit by a bus. An adult who's conscientious is less likely to end up in prison. And an older adult who's conscientious is going to see the doctor when something's wrong. They're actually going to do what the doctor tells them to do. My doctor friends tell me that 80% of their patients are non-compliant. But a conscientious person is. So that's the role of personality in all of this. And the role of mindset is that if you don't have the personality you want, and there are other factors that influence life satisfaction and health besides conscientiousness, but that's the big one. You don't like the way you are, you can change. You can change at any age. That's a mindset issue. You have to want to change. It's like the old joke about the psychiatrist and the light bulb. How many psychiatrists does it take to change a light bulb? The answer is one, but the light bulb has to want to change.
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing that stood out about your book is how many fascinating people you interviewed. And that made me very curious about what did you learn from the Dalai Lama?
Well, he was fantastic, of course, Joe. I mean, he's a great conversationalist. He's a prankster. Much of our time together was spent laughing. And he doesn't take himself too seriously, which is refreshing and fun for somebody of that stature. His advice about aging came down to two things. One is he gets a good night's sleep. He sleeps 9 hours a night. And that's great advice. Even at 85 years old, he tries to get his 9 hours in. It can be more difficult as we age to do that, but there are good sleep hygiene practices that are easy to follow. And then the other thing I learned is that he confirmed what neuroscience has found, which is that you're more likely to be happy if you're feeling gratitude and an urge to help other people. It's very difficult to get self-absorbed and focus on your own pains and aches and problems and life's displeasures when you're volunteering to help others. And he's spent his whole life doing that, and he's one of the most joyful people I've ever met.
When you think back to the people you interviewed, what are some of your other favorite stories? One story that you could share with the audience about someone you had a chance to visit with in the process of researching the book?
I think it's not that there was a single, I mean, all these people were fascinating to talk to, some of whom I had known. And so the conversation was on a focused topic, but there was an ease that comes from knowing a person, like talking to Judy Collins or Joni Mitchell or to George Shultz, the former American cabinet official who held four different cabinet positions and just celebrated his 100th birthday. Then there were people I hadn't met, like, well, Jane Fonda or Jack Weinstein, then 97-year-old judge, federal judge who still handled a full caseload. Jane Goodall, whom I hadn't met, but, you know, our paths had crossed because we're both in the biological sciences. And I think the thing that was most fascinating was they all had basically the same advice, which was don't stop. Just keep moving, keep growing, keep learning. Don't retire. And if you must retire, make sure you retire to something else. Jane Goodall isn't doing much of her field work anymore. She's semi-retired from that. But what she retired to was community outreach and community building. She's an activist who's trying to recruit children from all over the world to join the cause to fight climate change.
Many of the people that I work with as a coach want to keep going. They don't want to stop. They want to keep working, but often in some new ways, some different ways, after they retire from their first primary career. I think I know your stance on this, but what do you see as the pros and cons of working longer?
Well, I don't see any cons. I mean, if you're in a dangerous job or in a job where you're not physically able to do the things that are required because of age or disability, you should get out of that job. If you're a coal miner, you should stop mining coal at some point to protect your lungs. And of course, you can't have combat personnel who aren't fit. And at some point, we all age out of that. But there are so many other things you can do. You can tutor, you can advise, you can work as a volunteer. I was just talking to my father about this, who's 87, and he's still teaching at USC. He's gone down to, oh, I'm sorry, he's 88, just turned 88. He's gone down to halftime, and he was looking for something to fill his time. And I said, well, you know, the universities you graduated from, Berkeley and Penn, University of San Francisco, they've got these active alumni networks where they would love somebody of your experience to talk to current students or recent graduates or people who are mid-career trying to figure out their next move. He was a member of an honor society in law school. They have an outreach program for mentoring. And so even if you don't think that you have some skills, you do. You, in whatever job you did, even if it was in a large company with 100,000 employees, you gain some expertise that many people don't have. Or at least you gain wisdom that you may not realize you have until a younger person asks you for advice. And then you realize, oh, well, I do know about that. So I'm sorry, I see no cons other than if you're in a dangerous job or if you put yourself in a position where you're being ridiculed and frustrated, which can happen. But, you know, then there are other opportunities to find. It's all pros. That the most neuroprotective thing you can do for your brain is to use it by doing just what you and I are doing right now, Joe. We don't know each other. We're two people who have just met having a conversation. That involves more complicated processing than being a brain surgeon or or a concert pianist. I mean, this is what keeps you healthy and active and engaged with life.
Good to know. I appreciate that point. I was talking yesterday with some people that I'm working with at Encore.org and the Encore Network in particular about the Emeriti Center at USC and really how involved a lot of the retired faculty is and what they comment about. I had the chance to interview a bunch of them about 3 years ago. And to your point, the connection that they have with helping younger people from a mentoring standpoint, and also the collegiality that they maintain through that center, now virtual, but obviously physical space prior to COVID. So it really is beneficial, as you're talking about, the conversations that keep going and keep us sharp.
I'm glad to hear that.
So the next question I really hesitate to ask is it's really a single question about a topic that I know you've written an entire other book about, but here goes. How can music be helpful in successful aging?
Well, I think music is not uniquely helpful in aging, but having something that requires you to use your body, something that you can get better at, something that's enjoyable. It could be painting, could be playing games with other people. But music is the one I know the most about. And I just find it extraordinary that I can sit down at the piano and play a simple Chopin piece. I'm not much of a pianist, but I can play like the kiddie young adult pieces. And for an hour a day, I can put my hands where Chopin put his. And I can make some of the same sounds, more or less, that Chopin made. I can be Chopin. It opens up a whole world. I can read music pretty well, but when it's not well enough, I can listen to a recording over and over and over again and figure it out. And I'm training new motor pathways in my brain, and I'm engaging in a very visceral and satisfying way with the works of some of the greatest people who ever lived. And I find over and over again that people take an odd approach to music making, which is that they're reluctant to sing in public or to play in public because they're not experts. And this is about the only domain I can think of where people feel this self-consciousness and lack of self-confidence. So you don't see a couple of 30-year-old guys or women who love playing basketball say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I'm not going to join this pickup game because I'm no Steph Curry." You know, you play basketball because it's fun, and you know, you're not great at it, but it's fun. And you're not judging yourself. And you don't say to somebody, I didn't say to you when you called and said, "Will you come on my show?" And say, "Well, I'm sorry, Joe, I'm no Martin Luther King. Yeah. So, you know, I'm not even going to talk ever." You know? But we do that with music. And it's a shame. And it goes against tens of thousands of years of evolutionary history where we all joined in. And it goes against the research that shows that people in their 60s and 70s and 80s can learn a new musical instrument and get better and enjoy it and keep their brains active and find meaning in what they're doing.
So it's very clear from our conversation today and from your book that successful aging begins earlier in life. What's a short list that people listening can do to start preparing to age successfully at any age?
Well, I mean, some of them are a little bit silly, but important. Repetitive head injury is actually very bad, but doesn't show up until decades later. So if you're a kid or you have kids or grandkids, and you can keep them in a situation where they're not going to get pounded in the head over and over again and get concussed, they're going to be much less likely to develop Alzheimer's later. You probably won't be around to see which way it comes out, but that's a huge thing. I did talk to Bart Oakes and a number of Super Bowl winners. I think Bart was a 5-time Super Bowl winner, about traumatic brain injury. And they're all very concerned and all interested in learning about it. And Bart actually said on the record that he would advocate college teams moving to something like flag football. He doesn't think that would fly in the NFL, but it's a brutal sport. And the other kind of irony is that quarterbacks, and indeed, I'd say many, many NFL players, are just super bright and can run circles around a simple neuroscientist like me. And yet they've put themselves in this job where they're damaging the thing that is so valuable to them. So, I mean, that I say that that's silly because to some extent it may not be under our control, and to some extent it may be too late. But then there are lifelong habits that I think we can develop as youngsters and keep on working on. And three of them are conscientiousness, which we already talked about. As with all things, there is sort of Aristotle's golden mean. Too much conscientiousness could lead to hoarding behavior or OCD or things like that. But the right amount of conscientiousness is healthy. A second one is curiosity. People like you who are curious about ideas and other people are more interesting to talk to and have a more active aesthetic, intellectual, and physical life. If you're curious about nature, you're going to go walk in nature. You're going to exercise. And, you know, maybe you'll look at birds and bugs and bees and trees along the way. You'll explore new places. The third big tip has to do with deciding that you want to at least be familiar with what healthy practices are around diet, exercise, and sleep. I devote a chapter to each of these in the book, but I can boil it down to some very simple aphorisms. Out of context, they might sound banal, which is why there's a whole chapter around them to give you the biology around them and the science. But on diet, there really is no one diet that's better than any of the others. The best advice the real experts have is eat a variety of foods and more whole food, plant-based products than you probably do. But you don't have to avoid ice cream and french fries. You want to be mindful not to eat them all the time. But a balanced diet, a variety of foods, you need the micronutrients that are contained in a variety of foods. You can't eat just beans and rice. I mean, some people are forced to, so I realize that you and I here are talking to the socioeconomically privileged who may not have the choice, just as many from the lower SASE levels don't have the choice to social distance. They're living in one-bedroom apartments with three families crammed in together, and you know the adults are going out and being frontline workers or delivering groceries for the rest of us. They're in harm's way, and it's not their fault, and there's nothing they can do about it. So I realize I'm preaching a somewhat elitist message, which is be conscientious, be curious. That's not available to everybody, nor is following healthy dietary practices. And in many cases, the impediment is education. In others, it's that you're working two jobs and all you can do is soak some beans overnight and throw on some rice. But there's a goal there, and that's what I aim to put out. Exercise, the most important thing is physical movement. Whether you're actually running and jogging and exercising and lifting weights isn't as important as simple bodily movement. And we've talked about sleep hygiene. It's important to know what good sleep practices are, even if you don't always follow them. And they include going to bed and waking up at the same time every day, avoiding alcohol within a couple of hours of sleep, sleeping in a darkened room, wearing earplugs if noise bothers you, avoiding sleeping pills because they actually lead to poor sleep quality in every case. And that's really the long and short of it. When you're 20 or 30, you can drink, you can pull an all-nighter, you can eat french fries 3 days in a row, you're not going to notice it. By the time you're 60, one night of interrupted sleep can impair your memory for 2 weeks because the primary function of sleep is to consolidate memories, as well as some cellular housekeeping that it does that you can't do while you're awake.
All very useful, practical knowledge and advice. Really appreciate it. You're the first simple neuroscientist I've ever had the privilege of speaking with.
Thank you, Joe. It's been my pleasure.
And I appreciate, Dan, you coming on. And I know it's going to be very, very useful and helpful information to so many. So thanks for making the time.
Well, thank you. And your timing is good because the book Successful Aging, which is out in hardback now, mm-hmm. in every English-speaking country and some other countries as well, will be released in paperback mm-hmm. on December 29th, 2020. Or I might say, was released on December 29th, 2020 in paperback.
And certainly a book that I highly recommend, having read it as soon as it came out. And appreciate all your work and appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you, Joe.
We appreciate Dan Levitin coming on to share his research and insights on successful aging today. And a few things stood out to me about our conversation that I'd like to share and highlight. First one is really his comments about how we can really change at any age. As a coach, I come across people socially and sometimes professionally who believe the opposite. They think, well, I am who I am. I'm not going to change, particularly not at this age. In my experiences and his research shows, nothing could be further than the truth. You can really focus on things, change, improve, get better, shift at any age. And I think it's a good thing to keep in mind as we head into 2021. Second topic that caught my attention was his comments about never retire. I happen to believe that as well and see that people really get a lot out of maybe retiring from their first primary career, but then rediscovering, reinventing themselves, shifting into a period where they use their talents and experience and skills in some different ways, often to help others, often a more meaningful path where they're doing something to contribute to the greater good. Nothing wrong with really having fun, taking time off, relaxing, etc., but having that set of activities that are purposeful can be so important going forward. And I like the way he put it very simply, don't stop. Keep doing, keep being active, keep doing something meaningful. Topic three that got my attention was really the last segment where we talked about his practical tips for healthy living. He talked about conscientiousness being one of the key traits from the Big Five factor theory of personality. But he also cautioned that too much of a good thing can turn out not to be optimal. So watch things, everything in moderation is a good way to put it. He also talked about curiosity that can fuel a way of engaging with the world that is very healthy for us in multiple ways. And then finally, things we know, he underscored in terms of healthy practices, diet, the importance of sleep, and the importance of exercise, in particular, movement. I highly recommend this book. I had gone back to school for a master's in gerontology, so when Successful Aging came out, I read it right away for fun. But I find it to be a rich book that has a wealth of information from a scientific research standpoint, but it's laid out in very practical, accessible ways. And the way he organized the book is a good example of that. Part one, he talks about how we continue to develop and how our brains continue to develop throughout life. Part two, he gets into some of the choices that he talked about today. Diet, movement, and sleep. And then in part three, he talks about the trends in new longevity, the new longevity is the way he puts it. Looking at what's driving longer lives, how can we live smarter and enhance our cognitive capabilities as we age? And then finally, sums it up by looking at how we can live better and how this period of life can turn out to be the greatest days of our lives. And I think that's a good theme to take into 2021. Which of the things that he talked about today might be on your list to make 2021 and beyond the greatest days of your life? Thank you for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast and wish you all the best in the new year ahead. We're all glad to see the calendar turn, even though challenges lay ahead. It's good to see 2021. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today on the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. You can listen to all episodes of our podcast by subscribing to them on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher, or on our website at retirementwisdom.com.